there's just been ethics matter after ethics matter after ethics matter involving Mr. Young, and he skates by every time.
An investigation into Congressman Don Young's expenses. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state senators work on the oil tax bill.
I want to know a number. I want to know how much more, less, or the same this is compared to ACES and compared to the resources version.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
The U.S. House Committee on Ethics is creating a subcommittee to investigate whether Congressman Don Young violated the code of conduct. The subcommittee will probe Young's expenses and travel costs. Joining us is APRN's Washington, D.C. correspondent Peter Granitz. Peter, this is not the first investigation into Congressman Young. What's new here?
Well, the release is not specific to the charges, but a lot can be deduced from it. They're looking at specific things about whether he or someone on his behalf improperly obtained, received, or accepted gifts, improperly used official resources or campaign funds for personal purposes, or failed to report certain gifts. Now, that's the legal speak. It also goes on to say they're going to investigate whether he lied to federal officials. That could be potentially big. Now, the Ethics Committee was investigating Mr. Young during the past two Congresses. That could go back as long as 4 years, and it will continue onward. And it's important to note that it did receive a referral from the Department of Justice. DOJ conducted its own review, and it closed its case without a criminal charge. But it looks like people in the Public Integrity Unit at Justice think there's cause for a congressional action. And as for the charges, it looks like they're investigating some of the expenses and some of his travel costs that maybe he was looking to have covered.
What happens now?
I spoke with staffers on the committee, and it's worth noting this is a very nonpartisan committee. The staff is selected by both parties. They can't be beholden to anyone. And I spoke with some of them, and they said that they really cannot give any information. They're bound to keep quiet. There will be no more public information, at least not until we get a ruling on it. And they did not give an indication of the timeline. I also spoke with Pennsylvania Republican Patrick Meehan. He's the congressman who will lead the subcommittee. He says he's bound to remain quiet as well, and he would not even corroborate which charges this case applies to. I did speak with Melanie Sloan, the executive director of the government watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Her group has long been critical of Congressman Young. She says the committee has been investigating Congressman Young for years, and forming a subcommittee could actually signal something different.
There's just been ethics matter after ethics matter after ethics matter involving Mr. Young, and he skates by every time. The fact that there is an investigative subcommittee finally formed is a good sign, because the committee almost never goes to that step and then finds somebody completely innocent of all charges. Generally speaking, this is a serious step that suggests the committee believes a member has engaged in consequential wrongdoing.
Peter, as Melanie Sloan just stated, this is not the first time Congressman Young has come under investigation. What's the status of the other investigations?
Well, Melanie Sloan wants to know why the committee took so long to take this step. She says the Department of Justice referred this case 2 years ago. DOJ closed its own case. It's unclear whether the FBI has an ongoing investigation. It's possible it does. We just don't know. It had one operating on Congressman Young for years that closed in 2010 with a near indictment, but they said there wasn't enough conclusive evidence to convict him.
Peter, if there was a conviction or convictions, what are the possible punishments?
This subcommittee will have subpoena power, so if and when it comes forward with a charge, it could very well be a serious one, but that's a big if. The Ethics Committee has a checkered past, but like Ms. Sloan said before, having a subcommittee investigate usually ends in some kind of result. The last time this happened was Congressman Charlie Rangel, a New York Democrat. He was censured by the House. That's a formal reprimand. But ultimately, all that means is the House votes to punish them, and that's that. Charlie Rangel's still in the House. He got reelected. Congressman Young could be censured. It's also possible, though, that the subcommittee finds that he committed criminal violations. And if that's the case, it could go back to the Department of Justice.
Peter, were you able to get any comment or any word from the congressman, from Congressman Young today?
No, I did not. I reached out to his office early this morning, as soon as I found out. And Congressman Young's spokesman, Mike Anderson, said that it's important to note that the congressman is cooperating with investigators. And another thing worth noting, that the committee itself says just because they're opening an investigation does not mean he's guilty.
Thanks, Peter, for the update.
Thank you.
That's APRN's Washington correspondent Peter Granitz joining us from the Capitol. Legislation that would overhaul the state's oil tax system has been moving its way through the Senate. Today, the bill made it to the floor. While there wasn't a formal debate on the bill, Democrats in the minority took advantage of the procedural motions to raise questions about how the changes would affect the state treasury. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
It took an hour before the Senate even decided to swap out Governor Sean Parnell's original proposal for a version that legislators had revised over the course of weeks. Most of the time, adopting a committee substitute is a simple matter of process, but Democrats used the move to pepper the majority with questions about how the bill worked and what the ultimate fiscal impact would be. It started after Senators Kevin Meyer and Peter Michicki, Republicans who work for ConocoPhillips, offered to recuse themselves from voting because of a perceived conflict of interest. After they were overruled, Senator Johnny Ellis of Anchorage wanted to know something basic about how different versions of the bill compared to each other. Then, Senator Hollis French, also of Anchorage, asked about a provision that would lower the base tax rate by 2% after 2016. French wanted to know whether that cut was automatic or if it was tied to production. Senator Kevin Meyer explained that the bill should have the impact of encouraging more oil production. French wasn't satisfied with that answer.
But I didn't hear what part of the bill does that. Is there a section in the bill that does that, or is it simply a wish and a hope that they'll do as we ask?
Yeah, brief at ease.
Minority members asked question after question about how tax credits for new oil in old fields would work, how a credit to companies who manufacture equipment used for oil production would be applied, and so on. After almost every question, Senate President Charlie Huggins, a Wasilla Republican, would rap his gavel for an at ease so those carrying the bill could get answers from aides and administration staff. There were nearly a dozen breaks in total. At times, Democrats' questions went beyond the bill's mechanics and bordered on political statements. Without the numbers or political clout to push their own oil tax bill through, the minority has been on an aggressive public relations campaign to drum up opposition to the bill, which they argue will cost the state billions of dollars in lost revenue. Senator Bill Willikowski of Anchorage has been an especially vocal critic of bringing down oil taxes, and he expressed concern that the bill under consideration didn't generate enough revenue for the state when oil prices are low.
What are we doing in this bill to protect Alaskans at the low end? What's the difference between the resources version and the finance version? I want to know a number. I want to know how much more, less, or the same this is compared to ACEs and compared to the resources version. If I can't get an answer, say I can't get an answer. Say I don't know.
Amendments to the bill should be offered tomorrow, and members of both the minority and the majority are expected to offer changes. A vote could come during the same session, and if it passes, the bill will then go to the House for consideration. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A healthcare organization with thousands of patients in Southeast Alaska expects a massive hit to its budget. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH for short, says it's the result of federal spending cuts known as sequestration. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
SEARCH Chief Executive Charles Clement says his organization is bracing for a $3.5 million budget cut over the next 6 months. He adds, quote, "There is no possible way for SEARCH to absorb this amount of reduction." Clement says the reduced funding is largely because of sequestration, which went into effect on March 1st when Congress could not reach an agreement on the nation's budget. Search receives a large percentage of its funding from the federal government. Clement writes that he's traveling this week to meet with the Indian Health Service and other tribal health organizations about sequestration, and he says search executives are working with the board of directors to figure out what to do. He writes in an email, quote, "What I can tell you is that budget changes of this magnitude are beyond my authority to decide," unquote. Clement says nothing has been decided so far, but that difficult decisions are on the way. With more than 900 employees, Search is Southeast Alaska's largest private employer. It provides health care services to Alaska Natives and other beneficiaries at its hospital campus in Sitka and through providers in Juneau. It also works in smaller communities throughout the Panhandle. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, securing Shell's drill rig Kulik for shipping to Asia.
With three different tugs pulling on it with lines, it has a tendency to spin one way or the other. And once it starts spinning, it's hard to stop it from spinning.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The State Board of Fisheries started its meeting in Anchorage today. Board members heard Alaska Fish and Game staff reports as well as a report from the Upper Cook Inlet Task Force. The task force was formed last year to consider options in making changes to how late-run Kenai River king salmon are managed. Changes in those rules would influence Upper Cook Inlet salmon fishing regulations. Fish Board members Tom Klubertson and Vince Webster co-chaired the task force. Klubertson told the board poor Chinook runs last year forced fisheries managers to severely curtail all types of fisheries to try to make Chinook escapement goals.
What we had in that management plan just ground things to a stop at a point we perceived we weren't going to make king salmon escapement. We beached the sockeye set net fleet. We beached the in-river users, and massive economic impacts ensued.
Some recommendations proposed by the task force would set a July 21st date to take action if the late-run king salmon fell below a 15,000 fish escapement goal. Some of those actions would be to institute no-bait restrictions to in-river sport fisheries and to change some sockeye set net fisheries to management by emergency order. The Board of Fish has not voted on any proposals yet. They meet through Sunday. The federal government has a new proposal for defining handicrafts made out of sea otter pelts. But it's not what some crafts makers expected. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service governs hunting of sea otters and other protected marine mammals. Its rules allow coastal natives to hunt otters for traditional and subsistence purposes, and it permits pelts to be sold to non-natives after they're significantly altered. But part of the rules are hard to decipher, and different interpretations have led to citations, fines, and other legal action. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute President Rosita Wuerl is part of a region-wide effort to expand the otter business.
Our desire is to move away from the vague language that we've had that has, you know, resulted, I think, in some consternation, you know, with the hunters and with the craftspeople in not knowing, you know, what's legally acceptable.
The Fish and Wildlife Service has released new wording and is taking comments through May 17th. It defines substantially altered as weaving, carving, sewing, beading, drawing, painting, and some other methods. Fish and Wildlife spokesman Bruce Wood says artisans can make mittens, hats, gloves, purses, and scarves, but it prohibits some larger items.
If someone simply drew a picture on the back of a tanned sea otter hide and attempted to sell that as significantly altered. Someone who was running a souvenir factory conceivably could buy those hides and turn them into a whole series of little otter dolls and sell them in competition for people who are doing the work as a handicraft.
Wood says native craft people could work in cooperatives or other groups, but they could not use extensive mechanization or divide tasks in anything like an assembly line. He says the new rules include input from hunters and other groups.
So the service has been meeting with some handicrafter groups and other interested parties in an attempt to refine that definition and sort of take some of the angst out of the community of crafters who may not be certain that what they're manufacturing is legal.
Some people working with otter pelts are not happy with the proposed rules. Worrell says crafters work with the Indigenous Peoples Council for Marine Mammals and other organizations to come up with their own, more flexible proposal. But that's not the Fish and Wildlife Service draft.
All of us are busy studying it right now, but there's a lot of unhappiness that kind of came out of the blue. So it's like we're back to the drawing board.
The Heritage Institute is training tribal members to sew otter pelts to help build a cottage industry, especially in economically depressed villages. Worrell says the workshops have waiting lists and more are planned. The effort comes as hunters, lawmakers, and scientists debate the impacts of rapid otter population growth in Southeast. Bills in the House and Senate would subsidize hunting with a $100 per pelt bounty. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A fish processing vessel went aground near Yuzinki on Friday. The 169-foot Pacific Producer out of Seattle hit bottom between Kodiak and Spruce Island with 16 aboard. 10 were rescued and taken to Kodiak, while the rest hope to refloat the vessel at high tide. State authorities say no fuel spilled, and spokeswoman Sarah Francis of the Coast Guard backs that up.
The Coast Guard cutter Mustang went over and visited the vessel, took a look on board, confirmed that there was no damage visible from inside the vessel and that there was no water intrusion into the fuel tanks that would indicate any kind of leak.
The best high tide might not be until March 26th. The Pacific Producer had a bad fuel spill in January in Kodiak Harbor. Francis says the area where it is now grounded, with an estimated 10,000 gallons of fuel aboard, as well as lubes, oils, and about 6,000 pounds of ammonia, is habitat for a number of endangered or threatened species.
It is within the critical habitat area for a southwest population of sea otters, as well as the Steller sea lion. There could be Steller eiders present in the area, and these are all listed species on the Endangered Species Act. And there could be other waterfowl and potentially in the area overwintering.
The Coast Guard is currently investigating the cause of the grounding.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The University of Alaska Anchorage, where a freshman computer science course sparked a six-figure career in digital game design. The University of Alaska Anchorage, amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Preparations are officially underway for the Kulik drill rig's trip to Asia. Early this morning, three tugboats maneuvered the Shell rig out of its berth in Unalaska and onto the deck of the Xiong Rueku heavy lift vessel. Before the operation started, Marine pilot Carter Whalen said the Kulik would be a challenge to move because of its domed shape.
With three different tugs pulling on it with lines, it has a tendency to spin one way or the other. And once it starts spinning, it's hard to stop it from spinning, and it slides transversely through the water. So it's just kind of more of a balancing act rather than having to use a lot of power on it. It's kind of a finesse.
When reached today aboard the Kulluk, Whalen said the tow went smoothly. Engineers ensured that the rig was properly positioned on the Xiang Rueku. Then the heavy lift ship emptied its ballast tanks and floated upward, taking the oil rig with it.
Then there'll be a 4 or 5 day process once she's been floated, where they will secure and weld and reinforce the Kulluk into position before they try to cross the Pacific.
The ships are expected to leave Unalaska toward the end of the week. They're bound for Asia, where the Kulluk will undergo repairs for damage from when the rig grounded near Kodiak in January. An orphaned 3-month-old polar bear cub found near Point Lay is getting a temporary home at the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service spokesman Bruce Woods says the bear's mother was killed March 12th near Point Lay, but it wasn't immediately clear if the shooting was subsistence or defense-related. He says the man who shot the bear brought the cub to Point Lay, and later it was taken to the North Slope Burrow for evaluation, then transferred to Anchorage for care.
Once he's become acclimated and we know that he's healthy and well, then the service will begin looking for a zoo that has the facilities and the expertise and the capacity to handle him.
The bear cub is named Kuli, which is the Inupiaq word for Point Lay. Wood says Point Lay residents requested the name.
It's sort of a two-edged sword. This is a loss to the wild population that polar bears. Genetic material is lost to the wild population forever, and his life is forever changed from being a wild animal to being an animal raised in captivity. On the other side, there is hope that he will be able to be an ambassador for polar bears, and the people who would never have seen a polar bear in the wild will learn about them through him.
The bear is not currently on display in Anchorage. The Anchorage School Board said goodbye to Jim Browder and swore in a new superintendent at their meeting last night. KSKA's Daisha Eaton was there and has the story.
The Anchorage School Board voted unanimously to amend Jim Browder's contract for serving as superintendent, allowing him to leave the district in June. Browder said he regretted having to ask the board to let him go early, and he said a thank you.
I want to especially thank the staff, the teachers, the principals, and the community for the support and the understanding as I've been going through this. This is a really good district, and it's poised to continue that as we move forward. I'm proud of our numerous accomplishments, and I'm proud that the staff has supported and helped us push forward the things that are real important to student achievement.
In February, Browder told the board that he might need to leave the district to be closer to his daughter and grandson, who he says are experiencing medical issues. Earlier this month, he was one of 3 finalists for a job in Des Moines, Iowa, but he didn't get the job. Last week, ASD announced he would retire from the district just 8 months into his contract. The board released him from his original contract, which would have required 120 days' notice. Browder will get his salary and benefits until his end date. In addition, he won't have to repay his moving expenses of up to $10,000, and he won't be evaluated because of his early departure. Chief Academic Officer Ed Graff was sworn in to take Browder's place. Graff was named as the new superintendent on March 14th. Graff acknowledged the magnitude of his new job and said he hoped to bring balance to the district.
The role that I will play and believe that I have an obligation to do is to ensure that we focus on all of our students collectively and still meet the needs of everyone individually. And I think that's a balance that is challenging, but it's one that I think we deserve to give to our students and to our community members and to our parents.
Graff has been with the district for more than 20 years, working as a substitute teacher and elementary school classroom teacher and as a principal. Browder and Graff will work alongside each other during the 3-month transition. Browder's last day with the district is scheduled to be June 14th. If he needs to leave earlier due to family medical needs, an emergency termination clause in his new contract allows him to do so without penalty. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Northern Dynasty Minerals, a partner in the Pebble Mine project in the Bristol Bay area, has responded to the allegations made earlier this week by U.S. Senator Maria Cantwell. the company was misleading federal officials. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
In a written statement issued Tuesday, Northern Dynasty Minerals president and CEO claimed that Senator Cantwell's concerns have no basis in fact. Cantwell claims that Northern Dynasty Minerals has made contradictory statements to the EPA, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and investors about the EPA's draft Bristol Bay watershed assessment and the potential mine plan. Ron Thiessen admits that EPA may have used some of the information presented in the company's preliminary economic assessment to create their mining scenario, but he says it's the EPA alone that is responsible for designing and then assessing the effects of the hypothetical mine in the draft Bristol Bay watershed assessment. Thiessen goes on to say that to suggest that Northern Dynasty is responsible for the EPA's hypothetical project, which was evaluated in the draft watershed document, when the company had no involvement with the report, is wrong. In the news release, Northern Dynasty Minerals noted that the company's preliminary economic assessment presented a potential mine development scenario at Pebble, but it did not include all of the mine design information and mitigating measures that Northern Dynasty claims would have allowed the EPA to do a detailed assessment. The company claims the preliminary economic assessment was intended to broadly evaluate the economics of the Pebble Mine project, but did not include detailed engineering and other data. Thiessen asserts that Northern Dynasty's filings with the SEC are legal and meet all of the required standards for those filings. In the hours after the Cantwell letter to the SEC chairman was released, several organizations involved with the Pebble Mine issue released statements. The Bristol Bay Native Corporation issued a statement expressing appreciation for Senator Cantwell's attention to the proposed Pebble Mine. BBNC has taken a position in opposition to the mine and is calling for the EPA to step in and prevent the mine from moving forward to development. Northern Dynasty Minerals is based in Vancouver, and its principal asset is the 50% stake in the Pebble Limited Partnership. That partnership is looking at developing a large gold and copper mine just north of Illiamna Lake. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You could follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Ellen Lockyer and Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.